Well, today we're going to be answering another question submitted by a visitor to our website, spiritandtruth.org. And we seem to have had a kind of a series of questions in the last little bit that all relate to the topic of understanding the relationship between the church and Israel, and in particular, the topic of what is sometimes known as replacement theology or supersessionism, and that is the idea that the church replaces national Israel as a new Israel or an Israel of God. So this question is kind of related to that, and it has to do with Peter's epistle. So let's look at the question and see what the person is asking. The person writes, I am currently in 1 Peter during my daily Bible study. That's great that he's in a daily Bible study. Reading it at first glance seems like it's written specifically to Jewish Christians, similar to the book of Hebrews, mostly because of verses like the following. 1 Peter 1:1, to those who reside as aliens scattered throughout. 1 Peter 2:9, but you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation. Also, the fact that Peter was an apostle to the nation of Israel makes it more plausible he's writing specifically to Jewish Christians. I guess I'm assuming this was the majority of view, but it appears that that's not the case. Yeah, surprise. Commentators that I trust, like Ryrie and Constable, believe it is written to the church as a whole, and that the holy nation terms are a typology of sorts, that Israel was once these things, and now the church is these things. Seems kind of thin to me. There's one verse that makes me think it could be to the church as a whole, 1 Peter 2:10, which reads, for you were once not a people, but now you are the people of God. You had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Because the Gentiles weren't his people at one point, but these verses are quoting Old Testament verses like Hosea 2:23, talking specifically about the nation of Israel. So in my mind, it appears this is definitely a letter written to specifically a Jewish Christian audience. I was hoping you could let me know what you believe and why. Well, this is an excellent question. And to cut to the chase, I do believe that Peter is writing to Jewish Christians. But I want to mention to start with that the questioner is showing some excellent interpretive or exegetical skills. In particular, he's pulled out most of the Jewish clues, or most of the clues in 1 Peter that, in my mind and the mind of some others, make it abundantly clear that Peter is writing predominantly to Jewish Christians. And why does that matter? Well, it ends up mattering, as we'll talk about, because it affects how you interpret what Peter's saying. If you know he's writing to Jewish Christians versus writing to Christians in general, the things he has to say have a different implication. So let's look at some of the clues that Peter is writing to Jews, and most of these were mentioned in the original question. The first one that we would look to is the very first verse, 1 Peter 1:1. Peter says he's writing to the dispersion. That's what it's translated as in the New King James Version. And the Greek term there is diaspora, which is the scattering of seed, if you will. It's talking about this idea that the people he's writing to were once in a particular place, but now they're widely dispersed. And that's a term, of course, that's all through history has applied to the Jews, but especially ever since they had the southern kingdom fell to the Babylonian captivity, there's always been the situation where some number of Jews have been displaced out of their homeland. And the Jews that are in the displacement are referred to as being in the diaspora. So here he's writing to people who are dispersed, which again implies a geographical identity. The church, for example, is by definition dispersed, right? The church is global. It's all around the world. We're not out of our homeland. I mean, we are in a sense that we're not in heaven, but geographically, we don't have a specific area. We're all over the world. Also in the first chapter in verse 18, Peter refers to the tradition from your fathers. tradition handed down from your fathers. Notice your fathers. If you couple that with Romans 9, 1, 2, and 3, around in there, you'll see that the your fathers refers to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It refers to the fathers of the Jews. And if the tradition from the fathers is referring to a Jewish tradition, then the people he's speaking to are Jewish. Then there's the area that we're going to look at in more detail, which is 1 Peter 2, verse 9, where Peter reminds his readers of their previously declared Old Testament role as a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a special people. And there are many verses in the Old Testament he's citing there. Deuteronomy 10, 15, Deuteronomy 26, 19, Exodus 19, 5 through 7, and many more that are in that whole idea, those various ideas in that passage. So that's the part we're going to look at that's kind of contested. How do you understand that? But everyone agrees that he's definitely quoting Old Testament passages there. Then in chapter 2, verse 12 of 1 Peter, Peter urges his listeners to have conduct honorable among the Gentiles. Notice there, have your conduct honorable among the Gentiles. It implies that whoever these people are that are dispersed, they're out among the Gentiles, and they themselves are not Gentiles. Again, it sounds like they're Jews. Then in 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 3, Peter refers to their past lifetime as doing the will of the Gentiles. Again, he's emphasizing what you did before was following after the things that the Gentiles do. And the implication is that they're not Gentiles. And some people would claim that, well, he's using the term Gentiles there to refer to pagans and non-believers as opposed to, ethnic Gentiles. Well, I'm not so sure. If you look at how Paul, for example, writing to the mostly Gentile group of believers in Ephesus, the church of Ephesus, listen to how he describes them in relation to the Gentiles. He says in Ephesians 4, verse 17, that they should no longer walk as the rest of the Gentiles walk in the futility of their mind. Notice how he says the rest of the Gentiles. The Ephesians he's writing to are still Gentiles. He still refers to them as Gentiles. He's saying, he's making a distinction between Gentiles, non-believing Gentiles and believing Gentiles. So I think that emphasis on the rest of the Gentiles would be a clue to us that in Peter's context, when he says Gentiles, he means Gentiles. He's not talking about believing Gentiles versus non-believing Gentiles like Paul is. He's just talking about Gentiles at large. So again, Peter seems to be referring to Jews. Peter again mentions in 1 Peter 2:10, another thing we're going to look at, he refers to Israel's status, and I am saying it is Israel's status, of being not a people, now being the people of God. And we'll see as we look at that, one of the problems we're going to get into is that people assume that the idea of being not a people and then being a people of God automatically means it must be talking about Gentiles. But in fact, these citations come from Hosea, the book of Hosea. And if you look at the original context in which these are written, the passages are not talking about Gentiles at all. It's talking about stages of Israel's walk with God. For example, in Hosea 1 verse 2, we see one of the key ideas to the book of Hosea. The Lord began to speak by Hosea, and the Lord said to Hosea, "Go take yourself a wife of harlotry and children of harlotry, for the land has committed great harlotry by departing from the Lord." Now notice, Hosea's whole ministry is going to be a reenactment of Israel's unfaithfulness in wedding vows to her husband, the Lord. And so Israel departing is this idea that Israel was the people of God and then they departed from the Lord. And Hosea chapter 2 verse 1, due to Israel's sin, God declares, "She's not my wife, nor am I her husband." So he's declaring a separation. He's saying, you were once my wife and I was your husband. You were once the people of God, but now you're no longer my wife. I'm no longer your husband. So the people that were the people of God are now no longer the people of God. But he goes on to speak of restoration in verses 14 through 16. He's going to woo and restore her again. He says, I will allure her, bring her into the wilderness, speak comfort to her, and in that day you will call me my husband. And then it goes on to say in chapter 2, verse 23, I will say to those who were not my people, this was the Jews who were disobedient, you are my people, and they shall say, you are my God. So notice the whole three stages, the being my people, not being my people, and then being my people again, refers in all three instances to the nation of Israel. It's not talking about Gentiles. And I think it's incredible irony that the very passage which predicts Israel's apostasy and goes beyond that to talk about God's remaining faithfulness through that apostasy, this is the very passage that's often used to support the notions of replacement theology. I think that's pretty ironic. So why do we care about who Peter's writing to and what can we learn from it? Well, one thing is the implications for understanding what Peter's saying. Understanding who the author is, who he's writing to, makes a huge difference in how we would do application of what we learn, and in particular, understanding what's being said. And in particular, let's look at this particular two-verse section, 1 Peter 2, 9 and 10, which is where a lot of the focus is when it comes to discussing whether or not the church replaces Israel. And so often this is a passage that's used as a proof text by people who are into replacement theology to say, see, look, the things that are said about Israel in the Old Testament are said about the church in the New Testament, therefore the church is the new Israel. Well, let's take a look at the passage. 1 Peter 2, verse 9 and 10. You are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light, who once were not a people but are now the people of God, who had not obtained mercy but now have obtained mercy. So the common view is that this letter is written to Gentile believers, and that he's essentially taking Peter's fishing out passages from the Old Testament that were spoken to Israel, and he's reapplying them, in a sense reinterpreting them as applying to the Gentile believers in our day. And in the process, he's essentially transferring the responsibilities and the blessings associated with those positions over to the church and away from Israel. Let's look at this in piece by piece. So it mentions there that they're a chosen generation. That's how it's stated in the New King James Version. And the Greek is genos eklekton, genos being the generation part, and eklekton being chosen or elect. This is talking about God's election, another hot topic for another day. But when we look at the term genos there, which is in mine translated in this passage, generation, genos can have a wide range of meaning. It can mean kind, family, offspring, people, generation. So you have to really carefully look at the context to kind of get the overall flavor, which aspect of those various meanings is probably intended. And here the context is significance, as I've suggested. Peter is writing to Jewish people. And where does this phrase come from originally? Well, it comes from the Old Testament. And so, is it really people? Chosen generation? Is that the best translation? Well, here is one of those places where I don't think the King James and the New King James, even though I'm a big fan of the New King James and I use it as my main translation, I don't think it's got the best translation here. I think the best word here is race. And this is what you see in some other excellent translations that handle this, I think, in a little bit better way. The ESV, the NASB, the NET Bible, and the HCSB, or the CSB now, all say chosen race. And obviously, if it were to be translated chosen race, you would think twice about right away applying it to the church, because the church is not a race. The church is not an ethnos or a nation. Or we're going to look at that a little bit more in the next part. But so there's a potential when he says a chosen generation that he's actually talking about a chosen race, because he's citing stuff from the Old Testament that's referring to an ethnic group. It's not just a group of people, but it's an ethnic group. So the next part of 1 Peter 2, 9 and 10 refers to a royal priesthood and a holy nation. I'm going to skip over the royal priesthood for now, and we'll get back to that. But it says that whoever he's writing to, he's telling them they're a holy nation. Well, again, that is a reference to Old Testament passages concerning Israel. But the question comes up is the church a nation? Is the church a nation? And this is a little bit tricky question to answer and to handle carefully, because God does use the term nation in some passages to refer to a people group that does, you know, I think is clearly referring to the church. But in those passages where he refers them as a nation, we'll see he also says they're not a nation. They're not really a nation. And so we have to kind of look at the context of those passages to understand what he's saying. So some people would refer to those passages and say, well, God says that, you know, like the church is a foolish nation. So it's a nation. So let's look at that one of those passages and talk through it. Deuteronomy 32:21. God says about Israel, they have provoked me to jealousy by what is not God. They have moved me to anger by their foolish idols. But I will provoke them to jealousy by those who are not a nation. I will move them to anger by a foolish nation. So notice he's saying he's going to provoke them to jealousy by people who are not a nation. Okay, so the people group he's talking about is not a nation. He says it right there, not a nation. Then he goes on to refer to that same group, it appears, as a foolish nation. So what do you make of that? Who's this not a nation? And how can they be not a nation and a foolish nation at the same time? Are they a nation or not? And I think the answer to this is God is using a play on words. In this passage, you'll notice that Israel provoked God by foolish idols. In fact, literally, it's vanities. And the King James people have supplied the word gods, foolish idols, or useless gods. So idols isn't actually in the Hebrew there. It just says by foolishnesses. But because God says it's what the foolishnesses are pertains to not God, they've concluded, rightly so, the translators, that he's talking about idols. They provoke me to anger by their foolish idols. So Israel provokes God by foolish idols. And in return, God will provoke Israel by means of a foolish nation. So notice this is kind of like a tit for tat. Israel did this by their foolish idols. God will do that by a foolish nation. And in both cases, the things that are foolish are not really what they claim to be. The idols claim to be God, but they're not really God. The nation is not really a nation. As God says, it's not a nation. And when he says it's a foolish nation, there's a parallel there between the foolish idols and the foolish nation, is what I'm trying to say. So in the same way the idols were not really God, so too the nation is not really a nation. And then when he goes on to talk about the foolish nation, he uses the term goy in there. He says, by a foolish nation, he says, Begoy Nabal, or Nabal. That's the name of the guy from the Old Testament you'll recognize, who had the wonderful wife who tried to save him from being foolish. So foolish nation uses the term goy. And again, that's generally used to denote Gentiles. So it seems to refer to a group of Gentiles that he's saying are not really a nation and they're foolish. Well, why are they foolish? Well, I've already said, for one, that they're not truly a nation, and kind of like the idols are not truly God. But also, they're foolish because in the context of Deuteronomy, the Gentiles don't have the written revelation of God, the law. So one of the reasons they're foolish is they're without knowledge, right? They don't have the law like Israel does. So it's kind of like God says, well, Israel, you have the law. You're supposed to be intelligent and smart and godly. But since you're not, I'm going to make you jealous by a group of people that don't have the law. So this group of Gentile peoples do not meet the definition of a real nation, and they're without the law. And I take this to be a reference to the church, which ultimately is not a nation. That's what he says. And that's the way that Paul applies this passage from Deuteronomy in Romans 10:19, where he's discussing the context of worldwide evangelism. He even refers to the universal testimony of nature by citing Psalm 19. So in that passage there, it's pretty clear that the not a nation, the foolish nation, Paul is taking as a reference, a tongue-in-cheek reference to the Gentiles. So God is kind of contrasting Israel as the holy nation, and then the foolish nation there, which is not really a nation, is all the other Gentiles around the world. So that's the way to look at that passage. And I think it's pretty clear that he uses the term nation in relation to the church there, but he also clearly states that the church is not a nation. Another passage we can look at is Isaiah 65 verses 1 and 2, which read as follows. I was sought by those who did not ask for me. I was found by those who did not seek me. I said, here I am, to a nation that was not called by my name. I have stretched out my hands all day long to a rebellious people who walk in a way that's not good according to their own thoughts. So here he's contrasting Israel and a nation, it says in my translation, that was not called by his name. And he's saying, look, you know, Israel, I stretched out my hands all day long to them, and they don't come to me and do what's right, and they won't recognize me. And I was found by those who weren't even looking for me, that people who weren't called by my name. And so there again, I think it's pretty clear he's referring to the Gentiles who will seek him, even though Israel spurns him, especially in his first coming, in the incarnation, Jesus. And in those two, in that passage, the rebellious people uses the term am, which is we would transliterate it am, which is often, most often used to refer to Israel in contrast to the goy, which the goyim would be the nations, the Gentiles. And in this passage, the rebellious people are the Am, which we know from the context is Israel. And then the nation that's not called by his name is Goy. And I take this to refer to the Gentiles who seek him, who are not a true nation. And so the idea there of nation is it could easily be a people. It doesn't necessarily refer to an ethnic group. Goy does not necessarily refer to an ethnic, geographically bounded group of people that we would traditionally refer to as a nation. And so in summary, I would say this, that the term nation is found in relation to the church in a similar way that John the Baptist is referred to as Elijah. And what do I mean by that? Well, if you look at the passages about John the Baptist and Elijah, he is compared to Elijah and even called Elijah. I mean, Jesus says he is Elijah who is to come if you would receive it. So there Jesus is saying, well, he's Elijah, right? But John the Baptist, answering questions, says very explicitly, I am not Elijah. They ask him, are you Elijah? He says, no. So how can Jesus say he's Elijah and the people say, or he himself say he's not Elijah? It's because there are similarities so close that it's almost an identification, but not quite. So and I think that's the same way that John is walking in the role of Elijah, the role that Elijah would have had, and he would have been Elijah if Jesus had been accepted as king by the Jews. But because Jesus wasn't being accepted as king by the Jews, then John the Baptist is coming instead of Elijah, and Elijah will come later. And I discuss that in more detail in my teaching on the book of John. But what I want to mention here is that notice that John the Baptist is called Elijah by Jesus, but denies being Elijah. And this is kind of similar to how the term nation is used with the church. God calls it a foolish nation, and in the same passage says it's not a nation. It's not really a true nation. So in both cases, there are very close similarities. In both cases, there's clear passages that deny the exact identity. So the issue here is identity is not the same as similarity. Or another way to put it is similarity does not make identity. So Michael Black, who is a professor at the Master's Seminary and a dispensationalist, and has a number of good books and articles that I might recommend, he talks about this business about, in the New Testament, the Greek word for nation, which we see in 1 Peter 2. How is that really used? He says, though the Greek word for nation, ethnos, is sometimes used of Gentiles, it's also used on several occasions for Israel. In fact, there are 14 times when the singular form of nation is used of the Jewish people, including 7 times in the Gospels. And he goes on to cite those locations. He goes on to say, on the other hand, there's no undisputed references where nation is used of the church in the New Testament. Notice what he says. There's no undisputed references where nation is used of the church in the New Testament. And I'm in his shoes on that. This reference to nation in 1 Peter 2, if you understand it as being written to Jewish believers, isn't necessarily talking about the church. It's talking about Israel's role and these Jewish believers among the believing remnant who are still believing in Messiah and following God's will in the church age are still walking in that role for Israel. So now let's look at another passage or another part of this passage in 1 Peter 2, one which I do think we'll see does apply to the church, even though in this context I don't think he's writing to the church. And that is the phrase royal priesthood. So he mentions that there are royal priesthood, Peter does, writing to the people he's writing to in the dispersion, the Jewish dispersion. And this is a citation of a number of passages or an idea, and one of those is Exodus 19, verse 6, where this is said of Israel, "You shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." These are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel. So that's what God's telling Moses. You, Israel, are going to be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. And notice Israel is a true nation in every sense of the word. But even though this is spoken to Israel, and the passage in 1 Peter 2:9, I think, is also spoken to Jewish believers, I think it's true of them in two cases, because it also broadens out in Revelation 1:6. Jesus clearly applies it to the church at large. He says, "He has made us kings and priests to his God and Father." That's what my New King James reads. Here again, I'm going to have to criticize the New King James translation, which is my preferred translation for other reasons. The passage doesn't actually read what I just read in the Greek. And again, this isn't a textual or manuscript issue. This is true of the various manuscripts that can disagree in places. They agree on how this reading is. It actually reads Basilean Eris to Theo, which basically means a kingdom, priests unto God. Notice it's not kings and priests. It's a kingdom, singular, of priests, plural, to God. And that's how you'll see it reckoned in the ESV, the NASB, the NIV, the NET, and the HCSB or CSB. So notice when you read Revelation 1:6 as a kingdom of priests, that's the exact same phrase in the English that Exodus 19:6 says of Israel, "You shall be to me a kingdom of priests." So clearly, this is a place here when it comes to the kingdom of priests that not only applies to Israel, but also applies to the church. So there's some overlap here. So what is the church's relationship to Israel? How can we kind of summarize this? After we look at 1 Peter 2:9, we recognize that he's writing to Jewish Christians. They're Jewish. So things that are said in the Old Testament about Israel and the Jews definitely apply to them. But they're also Christian, right? We don't want to forget that either. I think what we need to see is that the church is a kingdom of priests. It's a kingdom in the sense that those in the church have been placed positionally in God's kingdom. As Jesus says to Nicodemus in John 3:3, you must be born again to see the kingdom of God. But at the same time, the church is not a nation, and it doesn't replace Israel in that national role that she has. The most that can be said is that the church serves in a similar role as Israel should have during the time Israel remains in disobedience. And that's a key there, that phrase. We're serving in a similar role, for example, a kingdom of priests, and we're clearly elect, chosen, although not a nation. But this is all taking place during the time that Israel is in disobedience. Remember, we were referring back to Hosea, right, to understand what's said in 1 Peter 2:9 and 10. Well, Hosea says the people that were his, that then are not his, will eventually be his again. There's a restoration coming, and the context there is not talking about Gentiles, it's talking about Jews. So there is a time coming, yet future, when Israel will not remain in disobedience. But in the meantime, in between that period of time, we have this church age where the church is serving in roles that are similar to some of Israel's roles, not the ones that are specific geographical or national, but some of the spiritual roles we do. We do pray, and we are a kingdom of priests, as it says in Revelation 1:5, 1:6. So there's a typological similarity. So this is where it gets a little bit tricky. There's very close similarity between Israel and the church in some ways, although there's many other differences. And there's a great presentation on the kingdom of God by Andy Woods on our website, probably the most exhaustive one you'll ever encounter virtually anywhere on the internet. And he goes through the specific differences between Israel and the church, and that's helpful to keep in mind. But here I'm talking about how they're similar. Israel is chosen as a nation. In fact, they're still elect according to Romans 11. The church is chosen, elect. The Israel was holy and set apart. The church is holy and set apart. We're sanctified, we're set apart. Israel was to be a kingdom of priests. The church is a kingdom of priests. So there's very close similarity there. And so typologically, there's a relationship. Israel is the type, and we're the antitype, if you will, of this kind of picture of people of who are following God. But yet in Israel's eventual destiny in God's plan, especially in its national aspect, hasn't been replaced by the church. While the nation function, you know, the national function of Israel is in obedience during this period of time, the church performs many of its spiritual functions. And so that's one of the things I think that led Fawcett of, you know, the JFB commentary, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Well, Mr. Fawcett there, he made the comment on this passage in Peter, 1 Peter 2:9. He says that the phrase holy nation there is antitypical to Israel. What he's saying there is that the church is facing Israel. Israel is a type and the church is the anti-type. They're both similar in their function as a holy group of people, but the church is not truly a nation, whereas Israel is. So in closing, I want to look at three different Bible commentaries and their comments as we wrap this up. The first one is the Bible Knowledge Commentary, which is a two-volume set that I highly recommend. The editors are John Walvoord and Dr. Zook out of Dallas Theological Seminary. And Roger Raymer, who did the commentary in 1 Peter, has this to say about the passage in 1 Peter 2:9 and 10. He says, quote, Peter again echoed the Old Testament, specifically Isaiah 43:20, chosen people, which used to apply only to Israel, and it's now used to both Jewish and Gentile believers. The responsibility once solely trusted to the nation of Israel has now, during this age of grace, been given to the church. Okay, so that's a dispensational commentary that's saying that. And he's saying that there's certain responsibilities while the nation is in disobedience that the church is carrying in the meantime. And it is getting back to kind of what I talked about earlier, that God is moving a football down this field to the goalposts. And along the way, he has, as Israel stumbled, the focus has shifted to the church during this period of time. So it's been given to the church, but it hasn't been permanently given to the church, which is what replacement theology would claim. If we look at the MacArthur Study Bible, which is a good study Bible in many ways, there's certain things I wouldn't agree with in there, but that's kind of probably true of anybody, any study Bible, and they wouldn't agree with everything I think either. But in there, when he's commenting on the Holy Nation, the person who's doing this section says, tragically, Israel temporarily forfeited the great privilege of being the unique people of God through unbelief. Until Israel's future acceptance of its Messiah, God has replaced the nation with the church. Well, I kind of shiver a little bit about how that's said. Because depending on which phrases in that description you want to focus on, it comes perilously close to talking about replacement theology. Notice he says, the final phrase, God has replaced the nation with the church. And I'm here trying to teach that, no, God has not replaced the nation with the church. The key thing, though, is he says, Israel temporarily forfeited the great privilege of being the unique people of God. And then he says, until Israel's future acceptance of its Messiah. And then the final phrase, God has replaced the nation with the church. Well, that's not the view of replacement theology. The view of replacement theology is Israel's done for in the plan of God. And all that's left that's of any importance is the church. So that's not what the MacArthur Study Bible is saying. It's saying a lot in lines with the Bible Knowledge Commentary that in Israel's stumble at the first coming, the function of a holy priesthood or a kingdom of priests has been essentially taken up by the church during this time. Finally, I think the Moody Bible Commentary has a good comments on this that bear reading, and with this I'll finish. This is Louis Barbieri, who wrote the section on 1 Peter for the Moody Bible Commentary. And if I'm not mistaken, I think he's a graduate of Dallas Seminary. I'd have to double check on that. He says, many scholars claim that this verse indicates that the church replaces Israel in God's program, that the church is the, quote, new Israel, unquote, and that ethnic Israel has significance in God's plans only as it is incorporated into the church that replaces Israel. But Peter's writing primarily to Jewish believers, and these terms are perfectly suitable for the present remnant of Israel, for Jewish Israel or Jewish believers during the current church age. This terminology pertains to redeemed ethnic Israel, not to Gentiles becoming part of Israel by virtue of being in the church, and cannot be used to support replacement theology. To which I can only say, amen.